Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Happy to have you along for the ride this week as we kick off the show with part two of my chat with actor Michael Muni, who plays the devilish but hot-to-trot Adam Newman on The Young and the Restless. Michael talks about working with his co-stars and how important social media is for him to communicate directly with his fans. We also chat with our pop culture expert Eve Thomas on giving Christmas gifts that benefit charities across the planet. These are amazing gift ideas and all for a good cause. We round things out with Kelly Rowland and a remix of her song, Down for Whatever.
Capture your need for sound.
Last week on the show, we had the awesome opportunity to chat with actor Michael Muni, who portrays the devious but delightfully delicious Adam Newman on the number one daytime drama, The Young and the Restless. And Michael and I had such a great time talking that we actually went longer than I thought, so I made the interview into two parts. So welcome to part two of my chat with Michael. And leading into this segment, I was actually talking to him about being on the show and what it's like to be on the set and getting along with his co-stars. And I said to him, working with his co-stars, it must be like a big family.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's very, very important that when you play a character like mine, when you play a pariah, when you play the person who's a catalyst but is such an antagonist at times, you need trust from your co-stars. They have to trust you, they have to be there for you, and you all have to be on the same team. So you have to appear like you're at odds, but in order to make the scenes go well and go brilliantly at times, and to have that kind of chemistry that I try and have with everyone in the show, I need their trust and their faith in me that I'm not going to blow the scene, and that if I'm challenging them in the scene, it's not me challenging them as an actor and trying to humiliate them or make them look different or catch them off guard. It's all in an effort to make the scene that much better so that we all look better. So my goal is to not just make myself look good in a scene, but to make whoever I'm in the scene with shine. And do some of their best work, because if they're giving their best work, then you're looking great. So I have to have those off-camera, off-set relationships with everybody where they trust me and they understand that I'm there to make things better. Because there is a contingent of competitiveness in Hollywood, and it's so strange to me because I grew up playing team sports, so this is kind of foreign to me, but there's this, you know, there's this concept out there that you look good by making everyone around you look bad. And I don't agree with that. And I don't like the actors that tend to just be so selfish and so narcissistic and so focused on themselves and so myopic that they're not aware of their surroundings. They're just these obtuse talking puppets that just care about how their hair looks. And, you know, if they got if they just keep up with the Joneses, and I don't like that kind of actor. And there are those kinds of actors on every set in every show that you're going to be on in Hollywood. You have to avoid those people. And I make a conscious choice to be something, you know, very different from that, the polar opposite, if I can, where people know that they can come to me, they can trust me. You know, that I'm not a gossip on the set and anyone wants to talk to me normal. I don't repeat things. It's just, you just build trust and friendship with people and show your maturity and your professionalism so that, you know, you and your scenes and your scene partners can stand out. And so, you know, here you could argue that, Adam has done the worst things you could imagine to the Sharon character, and he has the worst relationship with Victor, played by Eric Braeden, and Nicholas, played by Joshua Morrow. And I would argue that those three people are the people I'm closest to of the entire show, the people that I've hurt the most or have the worst relationship with. So there's a lot of trust there, and we get along, and they're there to encourage me, and I'm the same. And I think it makes for a better show. It makes for better scenes.
And I have to ask you, because you just brought up, you know, Eric's name, Eric Braeden. Again, he's been playing Victor Newman since the 70s. He's been on the show forever. Was it intimidating for you, Michael, like the first time you had to work with him, especially because you're playing his son and he has such a commanding presence?
In a short answer, no. I don't get intimidated by that kind of thing. I think the only thing I really get intimidated about are things that I dream up in my head. I can get myself all wrapped up over something and I shouldn't. So I'm really good about usually not doing that. But where it regards Eric Braeden, I see his alpha tendencies and his stage presence and that demeanor he has, where he could stare down a statue, you know, in a stare contest, and he wouldn't be the first one to blink, you know. But I like that kind of a person, and that excites me, because, you know, I'm an actor, and why do they call stage performances plays? Why do they use the word play? I mean, because it's time to play. Get out and play. And so I see someone like him, and I want to play. It gets me excited. I want to jump in the game. So, you know, as long as, again, getting back to the trust thing, as long as he knows I'm not there challenging him as a person or as an actor or his legacy or anything like that, but that I'm challenging, my character is challenging his character, then he really lets me sort of give it to him. And I'm the same. I allow it to be given back to me. But day one, he invited me into his room and introduced himself and seemed like a great guy. And I noticed he had an accent, and I asked him in German if he was from Germany. And so he sort of perked up and loved that I spoke German. My mother was born in Germany. And, you know, we started talking soccer and we had that in common. And so there was an instant sort of click there with each other. And so, you know, he was good to me from the start, and I wouldn't want him to be any other way when he's on camera, that intimidating alpha presence, because that's where Adam can show his alpha side, is when he gets to be with his father and, of course, with his brother. So you know, it's characters like that that are so iconic. It's actors like that that have such a stage presence over so many decades, that those are the people that you want to work with. I mean, if you had the choice and you're an actor that believes that they're talented and has some pretty good experience under their belt, like myself, would you want to work with a Meryl Streep and a Daniel Day-Lewis and a Robert De Niro? Would you want to work with people who maybe weren't so intimidating? I mean, I would rather get in there and play with the big boys and see, you know, let the chips fall where they may, you know. And so as it regards him, he's a joy to work with. I absolutely love his faith in me. And so, you know, we have mutual respect for one another.
Hanging out with us on the show today, Michael Muni. He plays Adam Newman on The Young and the Restless. Check him out, michaelmuni.com. Michael, you mentioned earlier, you know, that your character is a pariah, a shady character, to say the least. And it seems that Adam is, you know, always up to something devious. But at the same time, you know, we end up seeing this tender side when it comes to Sharon and her baby Faith. Is it fun to play both sides of the coin, especially, you know, trying to give Adam these redeeming qualities?
Yeah, it is. I don't think it's, I wouldn't use the word fun. I think I would use the word essential. It's essential if you're not going to have a mustache twirling villain, one-dimensional character. You know, you need that. You know, there will always be a contingent of people that I just sort of, I have to roll my eyes and laugh at, chuckle at, that you'll read comments of people online where, you know, I don't see any redeeming qualities. And, you know, he's a one-dimensional fool. These people watched two performances of my interpretation of Adam a long time ago, got themselves stuck into the ways that they're in and don't want to see anything else. But for the most part, the audience, I feel, based on tons of overwhelming feedback online, the people who constantly are you know, will when I am stopped in person, and people who write in, everything, and Twitter, of course, and all that stuff, there's an overwhelming abundance of people who, it seems, they've sort of grown and matured with my interpretation of Adam, where given a long enough timeline and a big enough arc, you're going to see Adam deal with different people differently, and so you're going to see different sides to this guy. You know, in the definition of a sociopath is someone who has zero remorse. And there are those times when the camera's alone with Adam, or someone's just walked out of the room or whatever, and he's alone, and there's a lot of guilt and pain and remorse, and he's a broken person in a lot of ways. And I think that most people have sort of matured with the performance and with my interpretation of this character, and they see that there is someone who at times will be harsh, at times might overreact. I don't always agree with where certain storylines have gone. I've said it before that I didn't, you know, I don't think that Adam would have thrown the memory card in the water. I believe that Adam is the kind of, and I, you know, I mentioned this at work too, when I read that script, and I thought, here we go, you know, because the truth is, I think Adam would have held on to that memory card because he's the kind of person who will use anything as leverage, anything as blackmail potential, anything as, you know, power that you can hold over someone else. So it was out of character. You know, we left Sharon at the altar. I think that too was, I don't know. But for the most part, the majority of the storylines and the things that Adam has done, however harsh he's done it, he's got other areas where he's remorseful about. And then there's his redeeming qualities that make him a human being. He might not be the most perfect human being, but I dare you to find any interesting character on my show that is a perfect human being, because to make a good drama and a good performance and something interesting to want to watch day after day after month after year, you cannot have a vanilla character that's not going to do anything wrong and is not going to rub anyone the wrong way. They don't call dramas dramas so that people can be happy and talk about rainbows and puppy dogs and ice cream. You know, you've got to create friction. So this is a character that creates friction just like everybody else in Genoa City. And, you know, he has his faults just like everybody else. And he's done things that in the real world, pretty much everyone in Genoa City should be serving full life sentences in prison for things that they've done. But in the grand scheme of soap opera and drama, you know, Adam is someone who is trying to find his way. And I try and show that through my interpretations and my scenes with the Sharon character versus the Phyllis character versus the Victor character or even Jack. But if he's alone with Faith, you know, there's, you can see certain softer sides of him and maybe wounded sides that can harken back to the days when he was a child and he grew up and he was lied to about who his father was. And then that person who was, he thought was his father died at a very young age and he had nothing. He could have some very difficult things, some not so good experiences locked up in his closet, you know, of life, his life's closet that he doesn't want to get out, but it's wounded him and injured him and created who he is to this day. And as long as you can show multiple dimensions to that character and you can show the good and the bad and the striving to be good, but the falling into the, you know, to the taking the easy route sometimes and doing the wrong thing, you know, you have a character that becomes very unpredictable. You know, if you've got a great, perfect, well-behaved character, they're predictable because you know they're going to do the right thing every time. If you have an awful, evil character, they're predictable too because they will always do the wrong thing. But when you have that person in the middle, that gray area where there's that moist, chewy center, you know, you've got someone who you have to sit on the edge of your seat and say to yourself, what is he going to do today? Is it going to be the right thing? Is it going to be the wrong thing? Will it be devious? Will it be honest? And so I think that this character really is kind of a landmine, goldmine, mothership for an actor, you know, to play, because there's just so much there.
And I wanted to ask you, Michael, what it's like for you when you came from primetime into daytime and then you met your fan base, because it just feels like there is it's a whole different vibe, you know, daytime fans. So A, does the Young and the Restless fans treat you okay? Can they separate, you know, Michael the actor versus Adam the character?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, there's a few squeaky wheels, but you're going to get weird, maybe not well adapted personalities in any line of work that you're in the industry, you know, whether you're doing movies or primetime or daytime. But for the most part, I made a decision early on, 2 weeks into the show, that the audience that watches this show has the same intelligence level as the audience that watched any primetime show that I ever did. And you don't want to pander to a daytime audience like somehow they're a lesser kind of a person and something's supposed to be more shticky and more melodramatic. I felt like I could give a performance that I would give in a feature film or an independent film or a primetime and bring that to daytime, and the audience would follow and they would support it and they would get it and they would understand the subtleties and see that, because they didn't need the melodrama to remind themselves that, oh, this person's upset in this scene. They can just see the twitch of one's face and they understand a lot, because we as humans, you know, we read people every day. When you interact with people, you can tell if people are upset or if they're holding something back or if they're angry or, you know, if perhaps they're even lying to you. I've found that the fans actually are very intelligent, very well-spoken, and also very, very well-read on the history and the mythology of the show. And they're, They're great fact checkers for the show, and very, very supportive. So I found no difference in them from any other medium that I've worked in. The only thing that I can think that where soap opera fans have gotten a bad name over the years is because the people that they watch 5 days a week. You know, any primetime show that you watch it once a week. You know, you're inviting this cast into your family room, into your house, into your bedroom, wherever you have your television, you sit down to watch, you invite them into your house once a week. You see a movie, a Matt Damon movie, you go see two of them a year, you know, but a soap opera actor, you see them 5 days a week. And so you feel like you have a more personal relationship with, and perhaps some people have been, you know, they feel a little too personal with the actors. And so, you know, people sort of interpret them as being crazy or they're fanatical or whatever. No, they're very supportive, and they do have these long running relationships that are very intimate with these characters that they've known over years. And because I understand that, I can see through that and see to the next layer of who these fans are and just how intelligent they really are, and how aware they are of what they're watching and, you know, what they want. So it's a good relationship as far as I'm concerned, where one hand washes the other. I feel like I get the audience. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's just my opinion.
And, you know, you're very active on Twitter. You have your own website, michaelmuni.com. Has being on social media helped your brand, as well as being able to communicate more closely with your fans?
Sure. I think that I was just saying this to somebody last night when I was driving in my car. I was on the phone, and don't worry, people, I was using my Bluetooth. I don't hold my phone while I drive. I realized that Twitter, for me, is my own reality show. You know, you see, if you watch a reality show of someone that maybe had a bad name or a bad reputation, when all of a sudden you really get to kind of walk in these people's shoes figuratively, and you get to see their life and you get to see a little bit more of who they are fleshed out, you start to understand them more and you start to notice things that you might not have noticed before, and you find yourself rooting for them, or at least understanding and sympathizing and empathizing. So with Twitter, I have my own personal reality show. You get to see pictures of me and my family, what I do, where I am, opinions that I have. I can be silly, I can be serious. I might have a differing opinion from you in one aspect and then the same in another. But I am who I am. And as you start to get to understand that, it's like you're watching a reality show and you're going, all right, you know, I know a little bit more about this person than I normally would have. And so maybe I am more inclined to be interested in this person. So where Twitter is involved, I think it's very essential, especially for someone like me who has spent the last 7 years playing the main antagonist on a show with both Sheriff Lamb and then Adam Newman. You know, I mean, I can imagine a number of people out there like thinking that I'm just stereotyped into playing this antagonist, probably because I'm that kind of a person in real life, when I couldn't be more the opposite or the antithesis of an Adam Newman or a Sheriff Lamb. But I can certainly play those kind of characters. But Twitter gives me that opportunity to show that I have a real life and a family and, you know, a normal person who makes mistakes and can be silly and goofy and sings to retarded songs in my car at the top of my lungs like all the rest of us do. You know, I think it's just a good opportunity to sort of pull the curtain back and show people who's standing behind that curtain, and that we're just kind of people doing the best we can.
And I have to ask you, you know, there's been a lot of upheaval in the soap world in the last couple of years with, you know, shows that have been on forever being taken off the air, Guiding Light, As the World Turns, All My Children. Are you worried about the future of the industry?
No, I'm certainly concerned for and feel bad for maybe one or two more shows that are going to go. But I really, truly, and this isn't a gut instinct, this is sort of an empirical opinion based on conversations I've had, data that I've had provided for me by studio and network and journalists and things, and my own opinion all mixed into one. It looks to me like, because they've shaved off so many of these soaps, and I think 10 years ago there were 13 soaps on the air, when you get it narrowed down to 2, 3, 4, 5 soaps, and I think we're going to be down to 4 here come February, 4 soaps on primetime broadcast television, those final soaps become diamonds. They are now very rare gems, and they're worth a lot more to the audience and to the networks. When you have the market flooded with soaps, then they're a dime a dozen. They're a dime a dozen. We don't want to be worth a dime. We want to be worth $1 billion. And so with a few remaining, I think we've become these rare diamonds. And we're going to be handled with baby gloves now by networks that realize these final few, maybe, you know, maybe they now have just the right amount in the market of soaps. Because if you look at daytime, you have 3, 4, 5 doctor shows, 3, 4, 5 self-help shows, 3, 4, 5 talk shows, 3, 4, 5 cooking shows. And now you have 3, 4, 5 soaps. So we're now sort of been pulled into the ranks of what the market can withhold and withstand during a daytime process. And so I think we have just the right amount of soaps on the air. And I think we're going to actually do better than people think and be on far longer than people expect.
And before I let you go, Michael, what's coming up next for you? Like, are you wanting to get into other aspects of the entertainment industry as you sort of get older and start to do other things? And where do you see yourself in the next 18 months to 2 years?
Well, I'm just going to let myself dive in heavy for the next 13 to 14 months in my show. Then after that, I'm going to be about 5 or 6 months out from the end of my contract. It will be pilot season 2013. And I'm going to look at where I am and what I'm doing and look at some projects. There's also some features and stuff that, you know, when you look like me, you are generally going to play a leading man. And so a lot of times, even if my name gets really close to making it in a big production, I'm going to get tossed aside almost every single time to the Leonardo DiCaprios and Matt Damons and the whatever. So it's very hard for me to fight into the film industry. You almost have to be famous to even get into a film. So how do you get famous, you know, on those levels? So I think I'm looking at branding myself over time and over the years in front of the camera with primetime and obviously Y&R. Y&R will be the only soap that I'll ever do in my life. It's a project that I love and that I have not given myself an end date, finish, you know, wrapping day for. I'm not sure how long I'll go with it. But again, to get back to the earlier part of the interview where I feel like I'm so rewarded and so fortunate and lucky to have a job that I love and I'm so passionate about, that right now where I sit, I'm sort of like, I'm kind of an if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of a person right now. And I like where I stand at the moment. And so I'm not looking to change things at the moment.
Excellent. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's actor Michael Muni again of The Young and the Restless. Don't forget to check him out, michaelmuni.com. Something that I wanted to bring to your attention this week is about services that you and I pay for. In this particular example, I'm talking about your cell phone service. Now, here's the deal. About 4 or 5 months ago, I realized that I was probably getting hosed by my cell phone company over my plan. Now, here's the deal. The plan was an antiquated plan. Parts of it were good, but parts of it I was realizing I was probably being overcharged. So I knew at some point I was going to have a little chit-chat with my cell phone provider. I was trying to wait till I sort of got into the fall because I knew that's when my plan was sort of due and I could have a little bit more leverage, I thought. Anyways, near the end of the summer, I ended up speaking to my sister-in-law. She and I both share the same cell phone provider, and I realized just how badly I was getting hosed with regards to the cell phone minutes, the daytime minutes. I was paying $50 for 700 minutes. That's obviously not including nights and weekends. And when I first got that plan several years ago, it was a fairly good deal, especially because a lot of cell phone providers at the time were only really offering up 200 minutes or 250 minutes. And I felt that I'd got a pretty good deal at the time. But then I spoke to my sister-in-law, and she shared with me that she had recently had a little chit-chat with our cell phone company, and she was going to get from them 4,000 minutes for $30. So as you can imagine, I was furious. That's about 5 or 6 times more minutes than I was getting for $20 less. So speaking with her basically, you know, lit a fire under my butt, and I ended up calling up my cell phone provider. And basically, you know, you kind of have to have a good approach when you call them. And I knew that there was no point in me talking to the regular, you know, customer service person. I went straight away to cancellation, which basically is retention and loyalty, that department. But it's basically heading to cancellation, you know, when you call up your cell phone provider. And I was kind of rip-roaring mad, as you can imagine. But I managed to, I guess, channel that into a good tone that I think ended up, you know, working for me. What ended up happening is I ended up speaking to this young lady named Hannah. And when she answered the phone, she was like, "Hi, Kelly," you know, after she got my sort of security, you know, information. And I passed that. And she was like, "What can I do for you?" And I said to her, I said, "Well, Hannah," I said, "I am sad." She said, "You're sad." I said, "I am sad and I am disappointed. I've been with you guys for about 7 or 8 years now. And I just find out that my sister-in-law is getting this kick butt deal. And, you know, I'm being hosed." Anyways, having that sort of approach by telling her that I was sad and disappointed and not being overly aggressive and irate, that just set the tone right away. And Hannah was very helpful. She ended up not only surpassing what my sister-in-law had, but pretty much by a wide margin. I ended up getting free local calls at any time of the day. So there are no more weekends or weeknights for me. Basically, if I call a number in my area code, I could be on the phone for 3 hours, you know, in the middle of the day, and I'm only going to pay my set rate for that. Which I believe is $45. Anyways, all this to say is that, you know, that was a good experience in the fact that I think some people call up and end up being irate and, you know, treating the customer service representative poorly. And, you know, it's their job to sort of deal with us. But I think if you can sort of channel your aggression in a positive way, you're going to get further along than if you basically scream at them. And I know that certain people, I have a friend of mine, that she takes great pleasure in calling up, you know, whoever, whether it's a bank, Air Miles, whatever it is, and ripping them a new one over what she thinks is a grave injustice. And it's unpretty is really the word that I have for that, because yes, she seems to get what she wants, but to me, I feel like they must red flag her account no matter what she's calling for. I just feel any, you know, customer service representative that has to deal with her needs to take 2 Advil after they're done. And I kind of don't want to be that way. I think I'm a nice person in general. And I know you can't be a pushover when it comes to these companies because they, you know, they're trying to help you, but not really. Like, they would like to make a profit and they'd like to get something from you, you know, pretty much anyway going. But I really think that you need to channel your aggression and sort of be, you know, firm but nice. And anyway, as the story sort of goes along, I ended up being very happy with her. I ended up actually leaving a message for her manager telling her how awesome she was. But here's the thing. Just yesterday, actually, I got my first cell phone bill after doing all these changes, because I ended up also getting an upgrade on my phone and all that kind of stuff. So I knew that it was going to take about a month to really see what I was going to need to pay for. Anyways, I almost had a massive heart attack when I saw that I was charged for $1,146.27. Now, that was not supposed to be my phone bill. And granted, I knew a couple hundred dollars were going to be for the phone upgrade, but I knew there was no way in heck that I was supposed to be paying over $1,000 for my phone bill. So I called up customer service, and again, I was very upset, to be honest with you, very upset over this because I couldn't understand what was going on. But again, I channeled this inner aggression in a good way, I feel, and ended up speaking to a first representative, and then he told me that what I needed to deal with was sort of above his level. So he passed me along to a manager, and she was great. Again, I was very forthcoming in the situation. Thankfully, I also am a big loser and write copious notes when it comes to any of this stuff. So I had the reference number from when I had made the changes originally with Hannah. I had the amount that I was supposed to be paying for my bill. I was just very anal. And because my story jived with what was going on, and then sort of looking at my online bill, the manager and I both realized that, you know, she had actually, or the Hannah girl from the previous call, had inputted a wrong code. And so I was, you know, on another cell phone plan than what I should have been on. And I had been charged $577 for daytime minute calls that I wasn't supposed to be charged for. So in the end, everything worked out. But I wanted to bring this to your attention because, again, I feel like when you have to deal with these companies, you really have to go in with a game plan. And again, I really feel it's important that you stay strong, stay firm, but be nice, because if you scream at them, it's unpleasant. And I really think in the end, it's going to come back to bite you in the butt. And also, the other sort of point that I wanted to bring forth is that you really need to watch your bills, whether it's for a cell phone company or, again, your MasterCard, your Visa. Be really vigilant about what's going on, especially if you've made changes, because there is a chance that there will have been a mistake made, and then you're going to get hosed, especially if you have direct deposit or they're pulling it directly from your MasterCard. So please be careful. And again, sort of really go in with a game plan, because I think it's going to get you further along than being crazy.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
As we march towards the holiday season and gift giving, there are alternatives to just going out and blowing gads of money in designer or high-end stores. To explain what I'm talking about is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who's also a writer, editor, and who has a blog called thegreatergoods.org. Eve, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Hi, Kelly. No problem.
Eve, can you please explain, you know, what The Greater Goods is and how this sort of ties into holiday gift giving?
Sure. Thegreatergoods.org is a blog I started last spring, and it's a Tumblr blog, and if you go on Tumblr, there's just a ton of sites that are really, they just boil down to, here's a cool thing, you should go out and buy it. So I kind of wanted to do something like that, but every single item that's listed on the site also has sort of a charitable element or a greater good element. So it's either really eco-friendly, or it's made by people in developing countries, or it's got several of these elements all at once.
And is this sort of like the criteria as to why these products are like a good holiday gift then?
Yeah, I think, definitely people around the holidays, you kind of, especially when marketing starts, you know, before Halloween, they just get really sick of consumerism and just, you know, everything being thrown at them. And yet at the same time, people want to give the people they love gifts, or, you know, the hostess of a party a gift. So they're looking for something alternative, but not that alternative. And that's where these products come in. They are all physical items, or in some cases, a music album, but, you know, they're not going to go in a landfill straight away, and they actually are supporting a nonprofit or a group of people that really deserve support.
And with regards to these, you know, charities that we're talking about, how did you, I guess, find them? Is it through the product itself that you found them? And do you do any sort of research into the charity to make sure it's actually doing what it says it's doing?
Well, some of them people send them to me, or I've read about them in magazines, or it's really everywhere on the internet, magazines, radio, everywhere where I found them. doing due diligence when it comes to charities is really important, especially if you want to, you know, be able to sleep at night. I do some initial research, and most of them are registered charities, so I do hope that that is enough. But I really do encourage anyone who's interested in any of these products to look further into each of the charities and just see, you know, how they work and what that, you know, if they're cool with that.
And I'm guessing actually, Eve, as you have, you know, found certain charities as you've gone along, I guess like when you're looking into the product that that charity is producing, you're actually learning about maybe a cause that you would have never known about before.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I think that's really one of the strengths of these. And I think traditionally it was something, you know, with really traditional marketing, it was something like, okay, you've got a T-shirt or a tote bag that just has this really kind of basic, usually pretty bad logo for the charity. And part of the idea was that you probably donate money in exchange for it, and then maybe someone might ask you about it, or maybe it would be advertising for it. But I think in the 21st century that maybe doesn't work so well. So for a lot of these things, for example, I have this really amazing, beautiful kind of African print dress, and I get complimented on it a lot. And actually, it was made by a brand called Boodoo that it was made inside a refugee camp in Ghana by the women there, and then they sell it, and then the money goes back into the camp for training programs and for all these other support systems for these women and their families. So anytime someone says, oh, what a great dress, I'm not just saying thanks, I got it at Winners or whatever, I get to say thanks. It's actually made by this really cool program that, you know, you can just Google and then learn about this nonprofit really quickly.
And some of these charities I wanted to ask, because as you know, like our show is obviously online, so it's global. So are a bunch of these places obviously like just worldwide then?
Oh yeah. I think everything I mentioned is, touches every point of the world. You know, some of the most recent ones are supporting money for Japanese recovery effort, a lot of stuff in Sub-Saharan Africa, and then just a ton of really kind of smaller charities that are all across North America, and just, you know, really it can be as small as, you know, a neighborhood no-kill animal shelter, or as large as something like UNICEF or Doctors Without Borders.
Joining us on the show is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who again has a fantastic blog that you have to check out, thegreatergoods.org. Now, Eve, let's get into some of these gifts. I guess I want to start off, you know, with the munchkins. Mm-hmm. What are some ideas for, you know, baby or toddler toys?
Okay, if you're like me, everyone you know has decided to have a baby this year. So they're probably being bombarded with gifts from everyone they know, and you really want to give them something that, you know, the baby will actually like and use, and also something that's not just going to break straight away and end up in the trash. So what I did when everyone got pregnant, basically, I bought a ton of things from this company called Little Sapling Toys. This was started by an American couple who has three kids themselves. And they only started in 2008, but they've already got over 12,000 sales on their Etsy shop. They hand make wooden toys using FSC certified wood. They're really, really cute. They're not just, you know, sort of hearts and teddy bears. They do really cool, unique shapes for their wooden teethers, like little guitars and little cameras and little ones shaped like the United States. And they also make building blocks. Everything's done organic wood, and everything's sort of bare. Nothing's painted. And on top of all that, you know, cute items that are handmade, they also donate a tree for every single toy they sell. They donate to Trees for the Future, and that's a charity that plants and protects trees around the world.
That's amazing. I think that's awesome. That's great. I think because I'm a nature lover, I think that's just great that they'd be, you know, watching out for the environment. Now, as we, I guess, sort of march forward, I think moms and grandmas are very important during the holiday, especially if you want them to make you food during the rest of the year. So what do you got going on for them?
Well, a really good mom or grandma or even a girlfriend gift is the Seven Virtues perfumes. Not just because they smell absolutely amazing. They're really good quality, but they also have a really cool backstory. I first heard about the Seven Virtues while I was watching the TV show Dragon's Den. I don't know if your listeners know this, but it's a show where business owners can come on and they pitch ideas to raise funds for their companies or their inventions. So there was this Nova Scotia woman on called Barb Stegman, and she started up a company, the Seven Virtues, by buying organic oils at fair trade prices from Afghan farmers who would otherwise be growing poppy crops to obviously make heroin. They make, I think, they account for about 90% of the world's poppy crops for opium production. So she, you know, gave them this alternative where she would buy this native orange blossom oil, and she made her first perfume called Afghanistan Orange Blossom. And then she's also, since then, she's done really, really well. She's gotten a ton of press, and she's also added a scent called Noble Rose of Afghanistan, which also smells amazing. And each bottle has 178 hand-picked rose petals. And then they also very recently launched a third scent called Vetiver of Haiti, and they use products grown by Haitian farmers who obviously were devastated by the earthquake in 2010 and events since then. So yeah, she's been getting a ton of press, and I think what's really interesting about the owner, Barb Stegman, is that she's really careful to note that this isn't just send money to Haiti or send money to Afghanistan. It's really a way to get farmers to be able to support themselves while not contributing, you know, to the World Drug Program. And she's also, I know she's got programs in the works for other parts of the Middle East and also in Sub-Saharan Africa. And it also works as a business model. It's not just some sort of pie-eyed dream. She's actually got a fully functioning business.
That's amazing. I am blown away by that one. That's very inspirational for sure. And then I know we cannot forget about, you know, our dads and our bros. So anything for the guys in our lives?
I have a few things. One of them is it really depends how fashionable your dad or brother is. There's this amazing company that my friend told me about. They're called Kila Kitu, and they make these cowboy shirts that are all based on this classic 1970s Stetson Western shirt. You'd know it if you saw it. And they make them in tons of just crazy color and print combinations. It was started by a Canadian, the company, and they're all made by Kenyan tailors. And the fabric comes from these markets called Mitumba markets. And that is actually where a lot of the clothing donated to Africa by the West and by Europe, that's where the clothing ends up, and it ends up being sold for really cheap. So this Canadian guy, I think he lives in Tanzania now, he was there and he got one shirt made just for himself. And then he realized that it looked really good. It was really easy for these tailors to make them. So he started this site where you can just buy all these beautiful, beautiful, one-of-a-kind Western shirts and these amazing materials. And it's all, you know, it's all eco-friendly or what have you, you know, they're recycling old materials. But they also started a local school lunch program in Nairobi, I believe, and they've got plans to start a training school for tailors and for entrepreneurs. You know, it's very, very much at the local level.
It's fascinating. Like, I think this is great. I think so many people now have so many other alternatives, again, than to just going to Future Shop, you know? So
yeah. And it's even more, you know, a lot of bigger companies are also doing, oh, we'll donate 10% to breast cancer research or 10% to UNICEF, which is great. And definitely, you know, look into these charities. If you want this product anyway, then you can, you know, great that part of the money is going towards there. But there's something really interesting when it's at a more local level. And when you could, you know, you can basically email all these people and ask them directly about what the money is used for. You know, they, most of them keep blogs, and there's really this level of accountability that is harder to find for larger charities. They release annual reports, but, you know, they can't tell you every day what they've been doing with your money.
So are there other things for guys and dads out there?
Sure. There's a really great product. Well, actually, it's for anyone who's kind of an outdoorsy type, but, you know, let's just say campers and sporty guys are usually pretty tough to shop for unless, you know, you can only buy them so many socks or snowboards. So this is Lulu Shea Butter, and it's also mosquito repellent. And Shea Butter is just an amazing moisturizer. If you've used it, you know, there's nothing like it. But it's also really popular, and it's probably one of the easier fair trade items to find on the market. I think the Body Shop makes a Shea Butter that's fair trade. But the line from Lulu Life is really special because there's not really a major middleman taking a cut. If you buy their products from their site or from their Etsy store, almost 100% of sales go back to the Sudanese Women's Cooperative that makes the moisturizer. and that money covers costs and helps them support their children, send them to school, and just basically helps develop their communities. It's also really interesting because they're not just making this product to export it. All these sort of farming households that sell the shea butter and make it the moisturizer, they also use shea fruit pulp, and they use oil like for cooking and for eating. So it's something that they'd be using anyway. And also, on top of all that, the business also helps conserve indigenous woodland in Sudan, which, you know, is helpful for everyone.
I didn't even know there was woodland in Sudan, so that's great.
I'm not sure it quite looks like our woodland, but yes, definitely that's where the shea butter
that's
is coming
fantastic.
From.
That's fantastic. Okay.
Oh, and also, well, on top of all that, so shea butter, great for anyone moisturizer, but this particular kind is excellent for campers or other outdoorsy people because it's actually a natural mosquito repellent because it has this ingredient called PMD, which is an extract from lemon eucalyptus, and it smells really nice for one, but it's also recommended as a DEET substitute by the U.S. Center for Disease Control. So it's, you know, it smells a lot better than a regular mosquito repellent, and I figure if they can use it in Sudan, then certainly it must be effective in the rest of the world.
Joining us on the show is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who has a fantastic blog. You have to check it out, thegreatergoods.org. Now, Eve, it's always hard, I find, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty when you have to buy things for teens and tweens. It's like my bane of my existence, trying to buy them something.
It's very, very hard to impress teenagers. I don't need to tell you that. well, what I would recommend for them is something from the Yellowbird Project, which is one of my all-time favorite groups because, well, one, it started in Montreal, where I'm from, but also it's actually... It's one big group, but there's a ton of little charities within it. And also it totally defies the convention of the charity t-shirt, which, like I said, is usually kind of this oversized, you know, not terribly attractive t-shirt with a big logo on it that you usually just wear to the gym or, you know, to do a painting
and
project.
And tie-dyed.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's something, it's almost, you know, you get it and you maybe donate some money in exchange for it, but would you really wear it otherwise? Probably not. But Yellowbird's t-shirts are all really cute and totally wearable, and they all come, they're all unisex, so you can buy them for girls or guys, and all of them are done by indie bands or indie musicians. So basically, Yellowbird says they have three goals. They raise money for charities directly through the t-shirts. They raise awareness for charity organizations through the artist's endorsement. And then they raise the profile of different independent musicians that they like. So, for example, there's a t-shirt there, really gorgeous, and it's from the band The National. And when you buy the t-shirt, the money goes towards Safe Space, which is a charity that supports impoverished families in New York City. And then there's another t-shirt with a really cute graphic design, and their money goes, it's for a broken social scene, and their money goes to support Lake Ontario Waterkeeper, which is an environmental justice group that supports water safety. So there's a really interesting mix of local charities that most people probably haven't even heard of, and they're usually really effective because they're very focused and they're small and they help people directly rather than having a lot of sort of administration. And this is also a really great case of buying something because you actually like it or think that someone else will, you know, finding a t-shirt in a t-shirt shop and saying, oh, that's a great little graphic design. I think my 16-year-old nephew would love that. And then you can tell them, oh, by the way, you know, The National designed this t-shirt, and by the way, here's the charity that it's supporting, you know, and takes 2 seconds to look it up online. So it really works on several different levels, and I think that's my favorite part about the blog, probably.
That's excellent. I think that's fantastic, too, just with regards to the arts, because I think sometimes, you know, it just gets overlooked or poo-pooed upon, so I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else, Eve, that we should be on the lookout for with regards to gifts for the holiday season that are going to help, you know, a good cause?
Sure. Well, there are a ton of them on my blog, but one that I just found, and I actually just bought it myself. I don't buy every single thing on the blog, but this... this I decided to spring for. It's actually just, it's an album, and you can either just get it through iTunes or Amazon, or I think that some physical CDs will be available. It's called The Animal Within Us, and it's an album put together to benefit Relief International's recovery effort in Japan. And the other interesting part about it is that it was released by Caring is Cool, which is just a tiny charity started by actress and comedian and musician Charlene Yi. Your listeners might know her from the movie Knocked Up, or she just joined the cast of House, where she plays Dr. Chi. She's hilarious. You'd know her when you see her.
Excellent.
And the album is, every single song is about animals. A lot of the songs are really funny. And even though I'll be honest, I don't think I recognize any of the bands on the album, because I'm not cool enough. it's really great. I love almost every single song on there. And in fact, you know what? If you could probably give this to a teenager, or to even, I think, you know, a 9 or 10 year old that you have no idea what they like. I think if they're cool, they'd probably like this album as well.
That's awesome and very interesting. And again, you know what? It's just so much information. It's so great. And I want people to be able to, you know, get a handle on this. Are there places that people can get more Greater Goods, you know, type gift ideas, as, you know, websites to check, as, you know, obviously your one?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, places I go looking for ideas. Well, there's 10,000 Villages, which actually has, they have real stores as well that you can go to, and everything in there is fair trade, but they also have online sites where not only can you find most of their products, you can also look a bit deeper into each of the people or groups supplying all their housewares and foods and things like that. There's also a really cool site that's been getting a lot of attention. It's called Shift, but it's actually S-H-F-T. And it was started, or it was co-founded by Adrien Grenier, who was on the show Entourage.
Right.
And he's been pretty serious about this. This isn't just, you know, a PR thing. He's been, I think he was one of the first celebrities to drive a Prius and stuff like that. He's pretty hardcore into eco issues. And they have a really, really nicely curated shopping section that's definitely the hipsters in your life will be very happy with the products on there. And lastly, one of my favorite sites for all items and not just charity-minded items is Etsy, which, if you don't know, it's a site where people sell handmade items and antiques and vintage clothing and things. But you can actually, if you just look for different causes, you know, you could look up AIDS or breast cancer, things like that. There are tons and tons of vendors who give a portion of their sales from their whole shop or from certain items to different charities. And more often than not, they'll actually scan and send you the tax receipt from, you know, as proof that you've that they've given the money. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
Just in case you don't trust them. You know what, like I said, you shouldn't just be buying something because it's for charity. You know, it should be something that has a purpose or that you like regardless. So on the off chance they didn't honor their commitment, you would still have a beautiful item that you enjoy, and they would, you know, have a million years of bad karma. So.
This is true. Eve, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate your time.
No problem whatsoever. I'm happy to talk about it.
Again, that's Eve Thomas, our pop culture expert. Again, check out her blog, thegreatergoods.org.
Capture your need for sound.
Well, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, including actor Michael Muni. It was so much fun to have him on the show. I really appreciate his time. Not to mention our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, and these amazing gift ideas that, again, are great for the planet, helping charities all over the world. Now, next week on the show, we'll be talking to fitness trainer Joan Pagano on how to be careful over the holidays so you don't pack on the pounds and go into the new year unhealthy. As per usual, I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Les Brown. Wanting something is not enough. You must hunger for it. Your motivation must be absolutely compelling in order to overcome the obstacles that will invariably come your way. There you go. Have a great week. Any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.